You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Wait a minute, that's the wrong music, man. This is the chef's music. Normally, I would not tell you these guys are associated with the Bright Side of the Road, but, you know, when in doubt, right, you got to go with what you got. And so they're normally, like, miserable people, but today they're, like, pinch hitting for a happy person. So joining me from Southern California is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, thanks on short notice for hopping in here.
Thank you.
You guys are becoming, like, the Sacco and Vanzetti of radio. We're going to talk about other things today, so it's going to be exciting. And Tim Lynch joins us.
Hey, man, that was good music for a bunch of old guys who are sitting on a porch chewing on a Viagra the size of a hockey puck. That's the kind of music you want to listen to.
There you go. That's a Jeff Kenny quote. 56 years ago, John Kennedy assassinated. Do you have a memory of that? Were Jeff, you were old enough. Tim, you were, I don't know if you were old enough, Tim, but Jeff, do you have a memory of that?
Yeah, I was 6 years old. I was in the first grade. And I remember complaining to my dad because cartoons were on Saturday interrupted by, I don't know if it was a funeral or if it was news reporting or whatever. And then I got in trouble because in class, we had to draw pictures of like the funerals and stuff, and I misunderstood the teacher, Mrs. Brown. So I drew this picture, and all my little kid drawings in those days, every kid had a round head, and everybody had a smile, you know, because I didn't know how to make frowns. So I had the depiction in the window of the building on like the sixth floor of a guy with a square pistol, like a .45, smiling. Shooting, I had dotted line going from the pistol to the car where the president and Jackie were, with the dotted line going through her head. So, and the president was smiling, and the first lady was smiling, and everybody in the crowd had that same kid fucking, you know, happy face thing. It was kind of like, you know, the happy face people assassination. The teacher, Mrs. Brown, she told my mom, and they were concerned about me. And my dad didn't hit me. He goes, "You jerk." I was six then. So that's my memory.
I'll give you mine. Mine was I'd never seen my mom cry before.
Right.
And that's like Jeff. I mean, I think I was in kindergarten, and I have a December birthday, and my mom could have sent me early, or I could have been old for my class. So she said, "Yeah, you're too stupid to go to school. I'll keep you home for another year." And so I remember I was in kindergarten, and she was watching it on our black and white TV, and I'd never seen my mom cry. I mean, that's the only reason I remember it.
Yeah, I remember my dad and mom being all upset.
Yeah. Timmy?
I remember sitting with my family watching the funeral and seeing John Jr. do that famous salute. But I've seen that picture so many times, you know, you don't trust your memory. That my first clear memory of my parents being upset, to be honest, was when the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan. My dad lost his shit. I remember that. The only thing I remember from this is the funeral.
You know what? And I want to say that my mom, that he saluted while my mom was watching, and that was because it was, I remember it being white, right? And it would have, which would have been the steps to the Capitol when they took the body. And I believe that's where he was when he saluted. Is that my imagination or what?
No, I think you're about so. Right.
Let me tell you, Jackie Kennedy, man, she could throw a funeral, man. She knew style. copied Lincoln's funeral, right? And, I mean, that is, I mean, talk about a memory blazed in the psyche of Americans. Holy shit, mm-hmm. man. And she walking, you know, she and Robert Kennedy walking, I want to say the short time they did walk, but she's Jackie Kennedy, man. She knew what she was doing.
Yeah, she's classy.
The Beatles, man, they released their White Album in 1968 on this date. Did you know that?
Holy cow, the album that inspired Charlie Manson.
Come on, Charlie Manson. I mean, what an absolute idiot, right?
And the only thing about him was the people who followed him were even more idiotic.
Oh, my God. And you read this. When the story broke, right, and I would have been, so what was that, 68?
When the murder happened, it was 69.
Okay.
But the album came out, you know, the year before, you're right.
And so, I mean, but think about this. So we're little kids, right? We're 10 years old. We grow up, John Kennedy's the president, Leave It to Beaver, right?
Yeah.
Dobie Gillis, F Troop, Combatter on TV. In the space of fucking 5 years, we're in 1968, the country's on fire, the Vietnam War is upside down, everybody's wearing their hair long, right? And the whole world is turned upside down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember as a little kid, like, what's going on, man? I don't understand this shit.
Yeah, me too. I thought it sucked. I mean, I had enough. I thought those college kids need to be shot dead right there. And when Kent State happened in 1970.
What'd you say as a little kid? Yeah, we're finally getting it right. I mean, what an idiot.
When they got shot, I thought, man, if there had been Marines, there had been more than four dead.
Well, I know, but think about that. Kent State, like, we're National Guard dudes, and we're on campus, and we have live ammunition, and, our hut guy says, stand by, ready? We're like, what?
Yeah.
They were burning buildings.
They were burning buildings down, and, I'll tell you one thing. It's wrong for what they did, for shooting into the crowd, but the riot ended. And what really ended the riots was shooting people ends riots.
Well, it is. You know, it is an effective technique. You're right about that. Wait till the PLA get it on in Hong Kong. You're going to see that shit come through a rip-roaring stuff.
I would submit to you that one of us would issue live ball ammunition to troops in that situation.
No, because you might have a lieutenant like Kenny who might yell fire.
Yeah, I would never do that because I'm too shrewd about my own.
your own destiny. I'm too selfish about my own. But I mean, you think about it, and you're like, are you fucking kidding me? It's like the My Lai thing, right? You know, I didn't know shit about My Lai, and the guy who was a guy named Ken Pipes, who was a company commander at Kaesong. I wanted him to come on my show, and Ken Rogers, who made the documentary Bravo. Have you guys both watched that?
Yeah.
Yep.
How about that? How about the start of fucking Bravo when you hear, you know, cricket, 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 and that dude starts talking about, we were laying in an OP and an NVA patrol walked up and I was trying to get my finger to the trigger, but I thought they might hear me. And then, the dude steps on my arm and I just froze. And then they started talking and they walked off.
Yeah.
Man. And then, Rogers told me, look, you have to have a good sound system, right? And you got to turn it up. Fucking Jack was under the bed in like 15 seconds, man. And then and then there's incoming the whole fucking movie. And about 20 minutes into it, you're like, this shit's driving me fucking crazy, man. How did they live like this for, you know, for 77 days?
And the My Lai thing. I mean, I'll tell you, I learned a lot about it, you know, through the years, but I learned intense about it since I started doing this podcast with you and then going to post-traumatic winning at Camp Lejeune with you. Here's what really leaps out of you about it. My first instinct was, it was like a sudden flashpoint. These guys just fired up this thing. It lasted for a couple minutes and then all these people were dead. Oh no. No, the truth is, it went on and on, included rape and deliberate killing, ordering of dudes to kill, you know, innocents, children, and shit like that. It was way worse than just a hot moment where somebody, you know, pull the trigger when they shouldn't have, like a cop would do,
right,
thinking a gun. No,
well, and that's what, and you know, different. That's what my experience was, and so I'm trying to get Ken Pipes to come on and talk about what it was to be a leader at Kaysan as a company commander. And fucking Rogers told him, he said this, hey, Mac asks hard questions. Well, what he meant was, I mean, they're thought-provoking questions. And that's what Rogers told me, why he likes. He said, you know, you ask me things that make me consider things in ways that sometimes I haven't thought about it, and I like that. But Pipes, who had ordered what's called the Ghost Patrol. And,
right.
They have a reinforced platoon goes out. And
Jockless.
Yeah, and it gets caught in a, what they believe was a, in retrospect, a two battalion ambush, right? And kind of a baited ambush. They sent guys, the lieutenant gets told, look, we've got fire support the whole thing through, do not deviate from the route. And then he radios in, hey, we see two guys, do you want us to go get them? And Pipes tells him, not if it takes you off the route. Well, they go.
Yeah.
And they get caught in this thing. The bodies stay out there for a month, and these guys can't stand it because Marines don't leave Marines behind. And so, but Pipes, I mean, I think he always struggled with that. So he wanted to get to know me before he would come on. So he would call me at night. He lived in San Marcos. He'd call me like, hey, Mac, what's going on? I'm like, nothing, Ken. What are you doing? He said, nothing. Figured I'd give you a call. And we talk about shit. And one night he says to me, he goes, hey, do you know anything about me, Lai? And I was like, well, you know, I know the basics, I think. But I didn't. Honestly, I didn't know shit about it. And so after I got on the phone, I thought, you know, that's kind of embarrassing. I should know some shit about it. And so I started watching videos, and I started reading about it. And it was nothing. I thought they'd been in country for a long time. They'd been in country less than 2 months. I thought they suffered a shit ton of casualties, which kind of along the lines that Jeff was talking. So they had this seething hatred inside of them, and then it exploded. It was nothing like that. It was on the orders of a company commander. Under the supervision of their officers, staff, NCOs, and NCOs, they murdered. They murdered women and children. And then you hear the story of the helicopter pilot, right? Hugh Shelton.
Yeah.
Holy shit. He says, so we're in a little bird. What were those, Iroquois or whatever those?
Yeah,
little,
UH-1.
Yeah, they're these little, like, you see them in Apocalypse Now, right?
Yeah, they're bell helicopters. Little bells.
Yeah, and so he says, we're flying around, and we see our tracers, and we hear the shooting, but we're looking for the other tracers. We're looking for bad guy tracers. We're looking for any signs, and we're not seeing anything. So we're spinning around the villages, and we're looking, right, and we don't see shit. So he lands his helicopter. And so he gets out, and he tells them his two machine gunners, they're both 18 fucking years old. Right? And he says, if those soldiers go near those people, shoot them. And he's telling, I see a video, he's telling this at the Naval Academy. And so he goes and asks the lieutenant, how do I get those people out of those bunker and get them out of here? And he says, why don't you throw a grenade in there? And he starts, he starts crying. And he says, you know, that one of the kids that they pulled out of this pile was the same age as his daughter. He said, so I'm trying to fly the helicopter while I'm sitting there crying. And it's an amazing story. But it was nothing like what I thought it would be.
You know who wasn't surprised by that story?
Who?
My dad.
Right.
I think you all talked about it when he interviewed. My dad worked the same area. He knew that unit. He said as soon as he heard, he goes, that figures.
And that was the Americal division, right?
Right.
It was Americal. Uh-huh.
You know, the thing about
very little regard by the Marines who would sweep in there and work off the ships every once in a while. Very little regard. He was not surprised at all. But disgusted would be a minor description of his reaction. I mean, how would anybody react? That's a story that's just horrible.
Well, you know what? I had your dad back on. I had Ken Rogers back on. I had Carl Marlanis back on. And I asked him, I said, was this a part of your war? And they were all, yeah, and they also, every one of them said no. Marlana said, look, we were fighting the NVA up north. He said, so the thought of, how could you rape anybody? How could you have a sexual thought, man? You were too scared you're going to get your ass blown away.
He said, especially the guys at 26 Marines, man.
Right, he said, I don't even know how those guys did that stuff. And Marlanis even went like a step further. He said, like, how could you even get an erection? I think he said an erection.
I know.
Right? When you're in the midst of that.
Right.
And so, yeah, the My Lai thing, it was, and then you see, and the video I use in Post-Traumatic Winning is a clip of a guy named Barnado Simpson, and it's horrible. It destroys his life, and ultimately he commits suicide.
That tape where
he's shaking. Oh my God! After his kid got murdered in America in a stupid shooting incident down south somewhere, right?
Wait, say that again.
Son got killed.
Oh yes, he did. In fact, and then he said it, that he felt it was his fault. It was payback to him.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, his son. His son is playing outside. And his grandmother's, and two kids get in an argument, and one gets a gun, and the other one runs in the direction of his son, and the one kid shoots, and his son gets hit in the head.
Yep.
But when you hear, and that's the reason that I play the video, because when you hear that, and I play it when we're talking about why you keep your honor clean. You know, you look at Marines, why do you keep your honor clean? Do you know? You know? I mean, can you answer that? And they say, no, they don't know why they keep, you keep your fucking honor clean for you. You have to put your head on your pillow for the rest of your life. And if we all know the most cruel fate, if you're in training, you know, like that helicopter pilot that crashed into my assembly area, he had to live with that for 2 seconds, mercifully.
Yeah.
But Sergeant Bazzarini had a 1-month-old son, right? The corporal that was in the back, his wife was pregnant. And, right, he had no right to do that with their lives. And so, you know, I use that as an example, but to me, that's the most gut-wrenching thing I've ever seen when he says, you know, and when I picked up my son, he had on his face the same look as the baby that I killed in Vietnam had on her face when I killed her.
Yeah.
And I knew that this was the punishment for that. And you listen to that and you're like, oh my fucking God. And then he commits suicide. I want to say a few years after that.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, and it's interesting that we're talking about this because I watch that shit all the time, right? I see it multiple times. I mean, every week I watch it. And so in the video, he says, I don't let anybody get close to me, right? That loving feeling is gone. And I thought about that. Do you think he didn't want somebody to be close with him? And because you see, he's a good-looking young guy, and could you imagine women get involved with him? And he's got what, anger issues, right? And you know, and whatnot that are normal when you come home. And then because he was public about it, she finds out or reads about what he did and what he was involved with. And at some point, I'm sure most women said, "You know what? I cannot do this. This is just too much for me."
Yeah.
And so, to me, that was the path that he probably went down as a human being. And finally, he said, fuck it, I'm not doing that anymore. Nobody's in anymore.
Yeah.
So, it's brutal. It's brutal. What else have you learned? Jeff, I mean, you're the fucking rain man of this whole thing. What about My Lai? Colin Powell was involved in the investigation. He got lampooned for that years later of covering it up. Because the only way this thing got reported by the Army was it got that Hugh Shelton reported up the aviation brigade's chain of command.
Right.
Because the AmeriCal division dismissed the whole thing. Nothing.
But it didn't come to the public's attention until a photographer on the scene with his private camera got out of the Army a year later, right?
No.
Yeah, when it was delayed.
Coming up. The guy's name, the whistleblower, if you will, is a guy named Ron Ridenour. And he was in Charlie Company, 1st of the 20th, and he left. They used to call My Lai Pinkville. He left before they did My Lai, And then he went to like long range, the LRPs guys, right? Long range reconnaissance patrol. And then he sees them when they rotate out of Vietnam. They're back in Hawaii and they're drinking. And he keeps hearing about Pinkville and the shit that happened there, but he doesn't believe it at first. And then he starts talking to people, and he says, if I would have kept it a secret, he said, they would have drug me into their shit, and I wasn't going to have it. So he wrote a letter, the President of the United States, the Joint Chiefs of Staff all got it, newspapers, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, they all got this letter that he put out with the photographs.
Yeah,
and they put that shit on all over the newspaper, and wow.
Yeah, it really was, because what happened right away was, this happens every day. It became this has happened every day since March of 1965, but then when you dig into it, you find out it didn't happen every day since March of 65. Matter of fact, these incident with a couple of Phil Caputo's guys, where, you know, he thinks I might have gave him the wrong wording and they went and shot a guy, right, where it's way, way less egregious, you know, not even close,
right,
to what happened to Milai, you know, or they, you know, and the same thing with Oliver North's guy who ended up going to another unit. That was another gag, or not really a gag, but when they said we're cutting down numbers of guys, they were, but what they were doing was, if you had, like say they're going to take 1-9 out of Vietnam in 1969, and so you got a bunch of guys who got more than 9 months in, they go home with 1-9 to, you know, Okinawa. But all the guys who got, like, less than 300 days, or, you know, less than 3 months there, they get transferred to other units, usually down in the southern part where it's more populated. So one of the North guys from 1-3, when 1-3 rotated back, ended up going to I think one of the 7th Marine Battalions, and he gets involved in this, killing of civilians. North goes and testifies for him in Vietnam from the basic school where he's an instructor in Quantico, and gets him off. But there's a private who was in that squad who didn't have any officer coming back for him, and this guy gets, his court-martial goes through, and his life is ruined. And he ends up, and this is in that book, Nightingale Song. James Webb is a fledgling attorney. He takes up cases for beleaguered, especially Marines. He takes this guy's case, and he's just about to get him an appeal, and the kid just kills himself. And it's in that book. I mean, you guys should, if you don't remember that, that's a pretty compelling part. You know, that's connected to what we're talking about, is that I used to think the biggest and most irresistible power in our lives was the power of the U.S. government, especially when it's focused and directed against the individual in the legal sense. But now an almost equal part is media. Right. When media is directed against a person, it can be as devastating, in some cases more devastating, than the laws after you.
Right. I agree with you. You see it all the time, especially with younger people that get involved in and so in over their head, and it doesn't work out well. They can't handle it. And you know, again, that dovetails off. One of the things that I say that I've learned in the last year is that, the problem with suicide in the country is not a mental health problem. The problem is that people are more and more overwhelmed.
Yeah.
They're not prepared for life kicking you in the stomach six times and then turn around and kicking you in the face four times. Now, our parents would have got a second job, you know, would have hitched up their pants and tightened them up, and our grandparents certainly would have done that. But we don't have those kind of coping skills anymore. We're not that kind of tough anymore as a culture. And
right.
So, you know, in my opinion, you know, we're paying – the suicide rate is a butcher bill for the way we parent and the way we school our kids.
And you know, you touched on something, Mac, that is something that comes up again and again in the lives of people who serve society, particularly serve society in situations, environments where there's going to be violence. So military and in a lot of cases law enforcement. And I remember reading a book by Robert Lucci, who was a informant I mean, he volunteered without being caught at anything to uncover corruption in the New York City Police Department. And as he's doing this, he just said, look, I'll do this, but I don't want to testify against my partners. And eventually he had to testify against his partners. And two of them committed suicide. And because they weren't, like, evil, but they were corrupt. And he, but what they couldn't stand was the approbation of their peers and being scorned by society. And there's a part in the book where Lucci is saying, you know, God damn it. You never hear about a mob. When's the last time you heard about a mob guy committing suicide or, you know, a dope dealer? These are people who are used to being scorned, and they don't have that. And it's kind of like the same side of the coin you're talking about, Mac, where, you know, you always are going for the approval, and all of a sudden you don't have it. And all of a sudden, you know, you don't have that, you know, you have the opposite if they're on you, you know.
Right.
And it's hard to resist for that type of individual.
Well, you're not prepared for it. You don't know it, and you're overwhelmed by it. And the consequences are real, right? Somebody came and repossessed my car. They're coming for my house, right? They shut down my lines of credit. You know, all the different things that happen when your life goes into the tank. And the only solution to that, right, is to tighten your belt, right, stiffen your neck, and get the fuck after it. But if you don't know that in your life, you can see, right? And so it's interesting. I got, when I was doing this with the Las Vegas Fire Department last week, I think, they call what happened, I think at the Wynn, right? That shooting, they refer to it as October 1. And I got told there's a couple guys here from October 1, you know, if you have anything to say about that. And so when the appropriate time came up, I said, look, and I understand that one of you was in the crowd and another one was a first responder. And let me just tell you what I'll tell you. You'll never get over it. Right? And I remember one guy looked at me like, that's it? I'm like, anything else anybody else will tell you is bullshit.
Yeah.
Okay? You're not going to get over it. You'll learn to live with it. And if you do what this program teaches you to do, you're going to overwhelm all that pain and all those memories. You're going to overwhelm it with good shit because you're going to touch the lives and you're going to create those memories on a weekly basis. And you're going to overwhelm your trauma both numerically and emotionally with joy.
Like you said yesterday, if you figure out a way to give meaning to what you went through,
right,
it'll help. It'll
Oh, my God, it becomes a tramp. The way I describe it now, it's a trampoline. It's a pit before you do that. But when you see it as, when you give it meaning and it takes your life above the clouds, that thing, and again, nobody wants that trampoline in their life. I got that. But you can't turn the clock of time back, and so you don't have a choice. And so,
you know what? Real quick, getting back to something that Jeff said, because that Mili stimulated an overreaction, which caught Marines that were probably not guilty of much and snared them in the net, ruined their lives. It brings up a point, and that is that, I mean, we're talking about all the bad things that naturally occur. Sometimes you're going to be a victim of situations like this that are manifestly unjust, but you're still the guy in the snare, and that's even... That's even more difficult, I would suspect. I just wanted to throw that in there because that pisses me off that we cover something up, we don't investigate it thoroughly, and then overreact subsequently, and the guys get punished for the sins committed by others. It happens. It
right.
always happens.
That's how we do it.
You know, there's the great series that came out, Vietnam in HD, and they had an episode where we had Marlantis. They had like two guys, Marlantis and this guy named Sergeant Weirich. And Marlantis, we all know about him, you know, the Marine officer who, you know, chose to go to Vietnam after his Fulbright scholarship.
Right.
And then the other kid, this guy Weirich, is one of these draftees who was smart. And he wasn't against the war. He wasn't unpatriotic. He wasn't running to volunteer, but he didn't resist when they drafted him. So he gets drafted, and he's pretty smart. I mean, he was like a tool and die maker on the civilian world or something. I could be wrong there. So they sent him to this thing the Army had that they call the shake and bake instant NCO. Like, right. you came out of, you did like an extra three, like 2 months at basic training, and you were Bing, a sergeant, squad leader. And they sent him to the 101st Airborne, and he goes to Hamburger Hill. They're going back and forth between Marlantis' thing up there in the Oshawa Valley and Weirich's thing in the Oshawa Valley. But Weirich's thing was Hamburger Hill. And he's going through the thing. And he ends up with the Silver Star, this kid. He's coming to the airport. He's wearing his uniform, you know, that chops that the Army used to have. Right. He's got his Silver Star on. He's got his, and people are throwing shit at him. His brother goes, hey, look, when his brother sees him in the airport, he goes, at the gate, when you could go to the gate, you know?
Right.
And, hey, maybe we should go this other way. So he goes, why? Why should we do that? He goes, well, you know, things are a little bit different now. And they do try and go a less traveled way, but they get caught by these college kids, and they throw shit at him, and they're swearing at him. He's stunned, and he's emotional. They're yelling at him about My Lai and shit like that. And it's, I mean, with a special brand of viciousness that you see nowadays in some of these college, ruckuses against, speakers and stuff. And I thought to myself watching, I go, there's more to that than just outrage over Viet. There's two things going on with those protesters. One is fear. They're afraid that what this guy went through and survived, they might be forced to go through and not survive. Or, and number two, they hate him. They hate him because he sustained the ordeal honorably, and they are avoiding the ordeal because as soon as the draft ended, the protests ended. I remember that. Like a fine dividing line. As soon as the draft ended, the protests ended. The whole fucking thing was really based on people were just either afraid or just didn't, they had better things to do than going to the service and going to Vietnam.
But that, I remember reading.
Really compelling if you watch that, that show.
And to back that up, I remember reading in the Atlantic a long article in the early 80s, I think I was at TBS, where a guy was writing about his boss who, when he drinks too much, starts talking about the combat, the air-to-air combat he's sustained over North Vietnam. The only problem is his boss never served in the military, and what the article about was this epidemic of people claiming to have some way, shape, or form participated over there because they were embarrassed for not having been there. I remember that in the 80s very well. I think he wrote a book on that. That was quite the thing for a while there.
T.J. O'Rourke. I mean,
it wasn't T.J. O'Rourke. He's funny.
You know, because he was a protester, and he realized that, but he's an honest guy, T.J. O'Rourke, but.
No, the other thing, and I grew up in, I'm living in Sacramento. Listen to this. So my dad's in baseball. Right. From between 1966, so 1965, 66 and 67, he's managing in Birmingham, Alabama, Mobile, Alabama. Right.
Right.
And then Birmingham, Alabama. And so we don't go in 65 because of violence in Birmingham. And so I remember being a little kid and seeing white only on fountains and stuff like that and think, well, that's me. And I never thought anything about it. I then, I'm in Sacramento, which is 60 miles from Berkeley, right? And there were kids that lived in our neighborhood that went down to Berkeley and they'd bring people back long hair, all this crazy shit. And remember, I'm a Catholic kid going to Catholic school. I wear my uniform every day. And they're sleeping on the baker's lawn across the street in their tie-dyed shit. And you're just like, what's going on? I remember seeing, every week, when Life magazine got published, Life and Look magazine, right? That was the internet of the day. You would go through those big pictures in Life and you'd see guys like his name, I think is Mario Savio. I mean, there's a picture of him on Life magazine with a fire behind him and they're burning something and he's flipping off the cameras, black and white. I want to say his shirt's half ripped off.
Yeah, he's got
remember that? And, yeah, exactly. And he, and it was at the People's Park at UC Berkeley and all that shit. But what I remember or what I think about now when I see that is the courage of the mob, right? The courage and the anonymous nature. And you see it now in the Antifa things.
yeah.
right, across the country. And it's like these punk fucks that all of a sudden they're so brave because they're in a mob, right? And they're walking up. And I remember being so pissed off when there was that gay conservative guy and they beat the shit out of him, right?
Yeah.
He's walking and they sprayed pepper spray in his face, right? They beat the shit out of him and people are walking up and they're slamming him in the head with shit.
Yeah.
And you just watch it going, and so to me, there's a there's a part of me that looks at the Vietnam protest and the crazy shit that happened. Now, I will say this. The majority of Americans that were bothered by the war went out and they protested. And there was huge protests around the country. And they did that in a way that, you know, we would all be proud of and approve of, even if we didn't disagree, even if we didn't agree with it. But some of that shit, man, and to me what it is, it's the anonymity of a mob.
Yeah.
And I hate that kind of shit.
Yeah, let me just tell you.
There's a whole psychology behind mobs. When you're an individual in a mob, you're sort of losing or relinquishing your individual consciousness to the mobs. I mean, getting involved in a mob is a bad decision to make for anybody in life. Because mobs are dangerous.
Yeah, let me say two things about that, if I could. Number one, the best book that we were ever forced to read, probably all three of us, was Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. And there's a part in there where the colonel, this retired colonel or whatever, single-handedly disperses a lynch mob. And he gives a speech similar to what Mac just said, you know, about about the fake courage of the mob, the false courage that is in the anonymity of numbers and a lack of, restraint. And he does it in a scornful, good way, and they walk away. And Huckleberry Finn says, I could have hung around afterwards if I felt like it, but I didn't feel like it.
I have a real world example of that. When I lived in, I lived in North Dakota for 14 years. The guy who was the president of the University of North Dakota is a Marine who fought on Guadalcanal, Saipan, and Iwo Jima. He was a president of the University of North Dakota. His name is Tom Clifford. So Tom is like this legendary figure in the University of North Dakota's history. And he takes it. It's now one of the leading aviation and aerospace universities. That starts when Tom and a buddy of his named John Odegaard take in like four Cessnas from somebody's will, and they start this little bullshit aviation program teaching people to fly because it's a practical skill that you can use in North Dakota.
There's a lot of Duke guys up there too. Now.
Oh my God, they've trained pilots from all over the world. Well, anyway, Tom, listen to this story. He comes on, and he played handball, and he was a robust guy into his 70s. And I walk up to him when Chuck Lindbergh. We had a big flood where I lived, and they had to rebuild the city. And
FEMA guy?
Yeah, Lindbergh. He grew up.
Flamethrower guy.
Yeah, he grew up in East Grand Forks, Minnesota. And so he was living in the Twin Cities, coming back to East Grand Forks, Minnesota to rededicate the Veterans Memorial. And I'm fired up as all fuck, right? And an Iwo Jima guy. And so I go over there for this reception. I get invited. I go over there. Well, I walk in, and here's Tom Clifford. And he's a powerful, guy into his 70s. And I walk up behind him, and I said, nobody's believing that fucking bullshit. You're in your 70s. How old are you, man? And why are you lying about your age? And he turns around, right? He turns around, and he starts laughing. He goes, I should have known it was you. I like, look, you can lie to all these other jackasses. I'm not buying your bullshit. How old are you? And so I had him on my show, and I found this guy who I went to a party with in San Clemente when I was a second lieutenant calls me in North Dakota and says, hey, man, I've got these CBS recordings of 4th Tank Battalion's tactical net on Iwo Jima. And I was like, what?
Oh.
He said, yeah. He said,
oh, I remember you talking about
right.
that.
And so,
those are cool.
Oh, my God. So I don't tell Clifford I have him, and I bring him out, and I said, I want to say it was in February of that year, right, during the time frame of the battle. And so we start talking about the battle. And in the lead up, he says, well, I got it to Guadalcanal right at the end of it. And, you know, he said, and so I was doing some door gunners. I was doing some door gunning on some stuff, and because I was a replacement, and then I got assigned to the division. And then they made me a tank platoon commander at Saipan, and we rolled over a aerial torpedo that had an anti-tank mine on top of it.
And oh, shit.
Exactly. And it blows my tank up. Everybody's killed except me. I am ejected through the turret, right? I'm ejected through the turret, and the butterfly handles from the 50 cal rip my whole chest, starting at my sternum, open down to my waist.
Holy cow.
Exactly. And he said, so the next thing I know, I'm still conscious, and I'm in an open-air, like, structure with, like, masonry walls, and the battalion surgeon and the assistant battalion surgeon, because when you went ashore on Saipan, you need one of those. Most don't have them. They're going to operate on me. It's open air, right? I'm looking up at the blue sky. They got the stretcher on sawhorses, and they look down at me, and they say, hey, Tom, we're out of general anesthetic. We're going to have to use local anesthetic until, you know, to do this. And he said, I'm laying there, and said, whatever. And they start injecting me, and then they're sewing me up. And yeah. Then one of them looks down and says, hey, Tom, your appendix looks pretty bad. Do you care if we take it out? He said, no. He said, and he said, and I, so Clifford says, no. And so anyway, he tells a story. And he says, but the story of him, he sends this riot home. So it's the guy who later would become the publisher and editor of the newspaper in town. He was a big time, you know, lefty Democrat, right? He's got his fatigue jacket and long hair, raising hell, and they've got this big rally going on, and Tom's the president of the School of Business at the time, and so he goes down, and they're blocking the armory. And they, you know, I think it was on a Friday or something. They're going to block the armory or some bullshit. So he goes up on the platform they've erected, and he takes the bullhorn. He stands there, and he puts his hand up, and they hand him the bullhorn. And he says this: look, we've all got your message. You've got plenty of newspaper coverage because that's all there was at the time, right? And he said, and now what I need you to do is you can't block the armory. So I need everybody to move away from the entrance to the armory. You can stay here for as long as you want and give your speeches. But this will be the end of this riding. Everybody understand? And the whole thing stopped. he was a legend for doing that kind of shit.
Yeah.
And he looked at the guy. The guy's name's Mike Jacobs. He goes, Mike, he goes, I expect this thing to be orderly. All right? There's no reason for anybody to get hurt here today. All right? And with that, he did it. It was like, the story you just told you. But in real life. And this guy was, he was the best, right? And he tells the stories about, you know, Iwo Jima and what that was like as a...
I mean, he had that horrible wound, and then 7 months later, he's on Iwo Jima.
Right, yeah. Well, he had time to heal. What the hell?
Yeah. Holy shit.
Right. And he told me all these great stories about... I mean, all these great stories about the... how they fucked with everything. He said, you know, we had guys that did everything in civilian world, right? We had guys who were optics guys. We had guys who, you know, and that's, he said, if you look at our tanks, there's wooden frames on the side with penny nails welded to the top. We fucked with the optics. We fucked with the, you know, we poured concrete in those wooden frames to thicken the armor. You know, we welded track to the side of the turret. We did everything. I'm like, if you fucking tried to do any of that shit, right?
You get a paid oven. Your career would be over.
Yeah. They would have let you. They wouldn't have. Would not have let you have gone to Iwo Jima.
Yeah. Right.
Well,
sorry.
It was a time when you were belting scrap metal on the side of your Humvees with carrier straps. That's probably the last time you could get away with that.
Yeah.
Huh?
Right. You know what? You're right. We did all that shit.
That's right. You sure did. I mean, I watched it.
Hey, you know what? You want to know something that I think about? There's a piece of video that I show. And it's General Nellie's birthday message. And it's where I got the whole post-traumatic winning thing from. And, you know, we've got a great family. We've got great support. you know, and blah, blah, blah. And at the end of it, that's when he says, we got to win, right? That whole thing. Well, in the video, there's Marines, right? World War II Marines on Guadalcanal and shit like this. How the fuck did we ever come out of World War II, like, with uniformity and short hair?
Like, oh, yeah, we didn't have short hair back then.
Oh, fuck, man. Oh. Everybody's got the bouffant going, and nobody's wearing the same fucking uniform.
Yeah, I know. I just did a thing on Peleliu, and I'm doing it. There's 8 medals of honor that were given there. And I got pictures of all these guys, and the living guys, like the officers had these, two of the officers had, they look like firemen, you know? Like a fireman's dress uniform, the cover. And, yeah, it was like, it wasn't until later in the war they came up basically to what we got now, you know? But,
I listened to an interview with this guy, Dean Ladd, who wrote Faithful Warriors. He was a PFC at sniper school on Pearl Harbor. Anyway, he goes in Guadalcanal, 2-1, I believe it was. After the invasion, they're the first follow-on guys through, and they're armed with 1903s. He's talking about how they all get M1s and steal them from the army. And he also was sitting right there watching the Battle of Sabo Island. They're up on the, they're dug in on that, on the hill overlooking that thing. They had no idea what they were watching.
Yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, that's nobody looked the same back then. It's kind of strange.
It's hilarious, man. I think it's so funny because, I mean, they would go from Camp Pendleton, right? Camp Elliott and all these places that you hear about World War II, in the San Diego area, and they'd go down to like photo studios on the weekend. And they'd have like their dress blues on with their big hair, right? And their cover cocked like as far over on your head as you could possibly, right? You see, I mean, and then it's like out of that, like we shave our heads in every uniform. Like where the fuck did I come from, man? And it makes me laugh because that's not the Marine Corps, man.
It was during Korea because, they didn't start wearing that DI cover till either late in Korea or after Korea. That campaign cover was something we had since the turn of the century, but it wasn't associated with drill instructors told, you know, late in the Korean War.
Yeah. You see, a genius move, whoever made it.
Yeah. Only marksmanship guys, you know? So you get the idea in your head that these things are perennial. They're not.
Right.
Like, the idea of leave after boot camp, that didn't start till 1973. They looked at you like you got a dick coming out of your head and said, leave? You've only been in the service 3 months, motherfucker.
You have how many days? Six and a half? Seven and a half? We're going to use them all up to send you home, and you're going to come back with none? And then you're going to be in the hole your whole life? No, you don't rate it.
Yep. And for your own good, they didn't give it to you, you know, so you could get some. Especially if you're going to go to Vietnam. You know, the other thing was, guys go to boot camp and ITR, whatever they called it then, and then they went to Nam, so they got to go home for up to almost 30 days because they're going to be in Vietnam, and they have a good chance of not coming back. I mean, it's just like Full Metal Jacket, 03, everybody, 03, 03. One, you know, 03, you made it. Everybody makes it, you know? But, yeah.
I didn't get leave after boot camp in 79. I didn't get leave until after A school. I've been in a year before I got leave, as I recall.
Yeah.
That was
79. Yeah, I got leave after boot camp in Paris Island. And then, that started when the volunteer force started because it was a way of competition.
That's another reason why we shouldn't do it right there. Just another reason to set us as different from the others. You make a career selling kids on that concept.
When I was the XO SOI West, we were trying to keep these guys from coming back from boot leave and saying they're either homosexual, which then we get you shit canned, had done dope, which they did, and then they popped positive, or that they wanted to hurt themselves or others, they wanted to commit suicide. Any one of those three things would get you on the road to being discharged. Because in their little inexperienced minds, they thought when they come back from leave that they're facing 3 years and 9 months more what they just went through in San Diego or Paris Island. They just couldn't handle it. So we should keep them. Don't let them go on leave till after SOI. And while they're in SOI, you give them a little bit of freedom. You let them go out in town. They have a little libo, and they see that things are going to get better. Some fucker wearing a recruiting uniform, you know, the blue deltas, he says, do you have any data? Do you have any data, you know, to approve that? And I go, yeah, we had NASA come to SOI West, and they did a study, and they found out about it. Really? No, not really. But you need a study to tell you that? You need a study to tell you the night is dark and the water's wet? Fuck you and your study. Everybody's laughing. But they didn't do it. I mean, General Padilla was right there and General Bailey, and they're both shaking their head going, Draft, you're banging up the wrong tree.
No, you weren't, though. That's the thing. That's
well,
the
no, you know, and the thing, let me just tell you, man, I think that's a cancer in the Marine Corps and the DOD, man. It's what point do you become a fucking politician?
Yeah. And they were saying, and General Padilla, both of those guys are straightforward guys, if you know them, right? And they're like, hey, man, you know what? How much shit I have? If the Chamber of Commerce of San Diego and Beaufort, South Carolina would go nuts if we stopped fucking having this big, you know, celebration for boot camp. I'm like, so what?
Yeah, but we've always done that, haven't we? Or do
well,
we not?
Yeah, you can still do it. The kid, no. Give the kid a 96. And
yeah, give him a 96, but and then back to work. I you're not helping that kid.
No.
You're not helping that kid.
Oh,
and
no,
that's,
no, you're failing him. You're
right,
failing every kid
right,
to go out like
right.
that.
Right, because here's what I've come to learn in the last year. They're dying for us to be involved in their lives. That's why they jump across the Grand Canyon. You know
yeah.
what I mean? I mean, the world that we all grew up in and then stepping in the Marine Corps was not a big jump. Them, and they have the right instinct, but it's intimidating. And then if you run into assholes, and this is why you can't haze them anymore, they can't take it. They don't have the constitution to take it like we did. I mean, fuck, we got on our bikes every day and rode all over the neighborhood, and you knew if you played in another park or strayed from your area of operation that there was a chance you were going to get in a fight. And if you got a fight, you had to fight. And that's when we were like 10 years old, man. That's right? I mean, that's how we grew up. It was more rough and tumble. They don't live like that anymore. But they, and again, I go back to the epiphany I had when, you know, I kind of was working on the Warrior Wellness Octagon, and 2-8 started using it. And I asked the battalion commander, you know, will they talk about this shit? And he said, oh, fuck, man. This is for my sergeants. They won't shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And so what that tells you is they're dying to have strong leaders. Right? They're dying to have strong leaders in their life because they come from fucked up parenting. They come from fucked up leadership. And now they're in this organization and we, you know, the Marine Corps gotta lead better. They, you know, it's gotta evolve the way it leads, and that all that knife edge and drill instructor shit has to end, and you gotta be what General Mattis talks about is that loving, caring leader, mentoring. You know, and somebody showed me how the British Royal Marines do it recently. And they said, man, they have these iron corporals. They don't raise their voice, man. They're just on them all the time. Do this now. Do this now. Do this now. Do this now.
The thing about IOC, when I showed up to you guys, that struck me different than when I went through in 88, is you guys just let the course be the course was the hard ass. And our job is to shepherd them to, I mean, what's the point of yelling and screaming at a guy who's going to go through a room of pain? What's the point of yelling and screaming at a guy who's going to run his ass back from R-15 at the moment of contact?
And you know the best story I've heard yet that exemplifies, I think, what we're talking about was Jeff's story about Bitch DeLuna. If you can't have a Bitch DeLuna that is so prototypical of so many units and so many good kids I've seen who are, you know, they get a nickname and it's a joke. It may sound like, well, you shouldn't call your men bitch. Oh, bitch, please. What the hell are you talking about? That's classic leadership. And any attempt to wipe that out is ridiculous.
He tried to get us to change his name, and everybody just laughed at him.
No, it's the whole point. Nobody said he was going to like his name, but it was so friggin' stereotypical Marine Corps infantry. I think it's a classic, and I think it's a perfect example.
Well, and then after a while, right, you don't even hear it, right? You just know that's his name.
Yeah.
Can bitch make it up that hill? I thought that was hysterical.
Right, and nobody even flinches when they hear it. They're like, where's bitch? He's over there. Right? And, I mean, Timberlake called some guy who had really bad acne, he called him Creature. Which was awful, man. I felt so bad for that kid. But, But I mean, after a while, you know, it was like, where's Creature? He's over there. And I mean, nobody associated with his acting. It was just his name. But, yeah, it was, it's tough. But again, what I see, and that's why you don't let them when they come back and they say, I want to hurt myself. And
yeah.
That's the new coin of the realm these days. Right? You call them in and you say, sorry, not gonna send you away. Cause I'm not gonna let you quit on yourself.
Yep.
And you make it really hard for them to do.
My first sergeant did that. I didn't know how to handle this kid that had, that claimed that he actually jumped off the friggin', BAQ and landed in the bushes right in front of Sergeant Egan. Sergeant Egan's like, what the hell are you doing? And, and first Sergeant
get
bought him in
hey,
his office.
Right?
Next,
get the fuck up. Get the fuck up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the first Sergeant bought him in his, cause they just bought him back to the duty hut and sat him in a chair all night and didn't talk to him. And the
have
first
you
Sergeant
guys,
bought him in and he said, you're absolutely going on this deployment. You're absolutely going to see this in point. You know, he was on that kid like white on rice. I don't believe we let him out of weapon or anything. I mean, he had to earn his way back in, but they wouldn't. Letting him go was not going to happen.
Remember Kiwi Kelly?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
He was an enlisted guy in the 8th Marines during all those rotations that, like, Timmy was on, going into Beirut and so forth. And he's got some stories about guys, Marines, trying to avoid going to Beirut. Like, he had a story about one guy who got drunk and tattooed on his forehead, fuck you, in the mirror. But because he did it in the mirror, it was backwards in reality. So he had fuck you tattooed backwards. And another guy staged a shooting. He said it was a drive-by shooting up there by, for those of you who are familiar with Lejeune, you know the theater where you did your thing there, Matt?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that area there, all the regiments are crammed in within, you know, 500 yards of each other. 2nd, 8th, and 6th. But in those days, 8th was over at Geiger. But this guy said there was a drive-by shooting on Geiger, and he got shot in the leg with a 22. Just shot himself with a 22 short. But Kiwi had some pretty good stories about that shit. But then you had the opposite, where you had guys, they want to get it on in Beirut. You know, you hear talk about Mike talking about 2-8 and guys who were in 1-8, you know, before and right after the bombing. And remember Colonel Kelly, the CO of TBS? When I first got to you,
Ed Kelly, Navy Cross Guard.
Navy Cross Guard from Vietnam, company commander. But he took a group of dudes from 6th Marines into there because the people who got killed during the bombing were mostly BLT headquarters guys.
Right.
Yeah, and they had some pretty good, pretty good vignettes there. So it's just, it's just funny as hell. I have to tell you though, the Marine Corps infantry guys, maybe it's not just infantry guys, but the Marine Corps skill at nicknames and is legendary. I'm going to give Tim Lynch a shout out here. Tim comes back from going to the new research center. He says, yeah, I was over. I saw so-and-so in the room of losers. And I'm, the room of losers, what's that? Well, you know, guys who get relieved from here for screwing with people. Remember that, Timmy?
Yeah, because you had to be polite to them, because when we were down there copying all that crap out of books, their offices, their desks were down there, because they're in the basement.
Island of Misfit. Nobody wants those Nosbitch in the box. Yeah, you should do, like, that would be a good idea for a podcast. It's like Marine Corps, sayings, like shit or go blind time, and Joe Shit the Rag Man. And
off ramp of the Marine Corps.
Yeah, he clicked off save, shit like that. Yeah, really,
No, you hear this shit, right? You like, and then all of a sudden you hear it, and it just starts laughing.
Yeah.
Right? And you just start laughing, and, I remember the first time, now this is kind of graphic, vulgar, but I burst out laughing, and it was at OCS. And, and somebody said, get your dick skinners off my shit.
Yeah, right.
And I was like, what does that mean? And like, dick skinners are fingers. Like, what? Get your fingers off my shit. Man, yeah. I started laughing my ass off, right? And you hear, and here's the beautiful thing about it, right? It's not the brightest people in the world, right? But they're motivated and they talk a ton of shit and they're high school educated. And it's from that concoction that these names spill from.
Yeah, Kennedy used to do that. He used to answer you with pieces of Jody. Like I say, hey, did that general show up for this? Some general's going to watch our stuff. He goes, yeah. I go, what is he like? And he goes, he's got a ping pong pussy. So I meet the guy. I'm trying not to laugh in his face because I'm thinking, he has a ping pong pussy, according to Paul Kennedy. You know?
But you hear this shit, right? And it makes sense in this culture, and it's just and it's normally vulgar, but you know what? It is absolutely positively hilarious. Let me say something about Ed Kelly. Ed Kelly, his Navy Cross, right? He reports to basic school company commander, and they as a company commander leads an attack in a South Vietnamese National Park against an NVA, I believe it, an NVA company or battalion. And then he defends against a counterattack. They run out of ammunition and the weather's socked in so they can't get resupplied, and they defend against a counterattack with NVA weapons. And they repel the counterattack, and that's what his Navy Cross is for.
That's great. Yeah.
He promoted me to captain, and he promoted me to captain the day that we qualified. I was a SPC with Fox Company, so the day we qualified on the range. And so the company was lined up, and he came in, and my wife was there and everything. And I'm standing there, I shot expert on pistol and rifle, so I had no insignia on. And he stands in front of me, and in a low voice, he goes, you come see me at the end of this thing, Captain Lynch. I don't like this non-insignia stuff. And he puts the captain bar's arm, and he's looking around at the lieutenants, and he looks at me, he goes, did you just qualify on the range? I say, yes, sir, double expert. He goes, good job. Don't bother coming soon. I thought I was dead. He caught that one quick, though. He was a smart guy.
He
joked about that.
Let me tell you, though, the guys who raised us, man, I mean, they would – I remember – I mean, and Colonel Kelly was kind of a quiet guy, right? And he's –
Colonel Ebert was before him.
Yeah, Ebert was, too.
Another Navy Cross guy.
Oh, my God. And so Kelly came out to do the fireside chat at IOC, and we got the maps of the national park. And, I mean, to just sit – it was – that those experiences are kind of like the battlefield studies I do. And to sit them, to see them sit with the maps and begin to retell the story.
Yeah.
Holy shit. I mean, that was always just the most incredible experiences. And these guys were tough guys, man. The guys who fought with Tim's dad, right?
Yeah.
In the northern part of I Corps, that was, you know, Vietnam.
That was Fargo.
Yeah.
Argo, man.
Yeah, that was some serious shit. And they would come and they would tell you. And then, you know, now what I've learned is how fucked up we were, right? You know, LZ Margo, right? The Battle of Gitlin's Corner. These jerk-offs that don't know what the fuck they're doing telling you to do something. They have no fucking idea. And there's no commander's intent in the Marine Corps. We don't even know that kind of shit yet. And so you had a choice whether you would do what Jim Bathurst did, which is he just wouldn't do stupid shit. And he didn't care if you gave him an order. He'd say Roger, wouldn't argue, and he'd go about and he'd do what he thought was right. He said, I want to get my Marines killed for some idiot. And so so you hear those stories and from these guys, and then, you know, we served with them, right? I mean, we served with those guys. They were all senior guys in the Marine Corps, were all Vietnam vets, man. And they were...
You know, it was like that Colonel, the German dude, Colonel... Fuck. Oh, God damn it.
Ooh, I know who you're talking about, Jeff. I remember this guy. The one that came and visited us. From the Boons War.
He had a German accent. What was his name? Colonel, and but I remember he gave a class to us at 8th Marines about fit reps. All the lieutenants and captains. And he had that German accent, right? He said, here's an example, and this is when we had the old fit rep in the Section C's. Here's an example of a good Section C comment. Judging by this officer's personal appearance, he should be meritoriously promoted to Navy Chief.
Shit.
This officer continues to be marked outstanding in Block 11 in the same way hair and fingernails grow on a corpse after it is dead. I'll never forget those words.
Oh, shit. And you know what? And again, the other thing about the Marine Corps then was, you know, you could be a functioning alcoholic, right?
Yeah.
You could be a brawling, functional alcoholic, but don't go ask for help because that will end you as a professional. Oh, yeah. Can't hack it.
Hey, I tell you something that's interesting is that speaking of LZ Margo, the Marines from 226 are slowly but surely getting together, those that have survived, and they've been trying to piece together a website to piece together what happened. And my dad got involved, and he's the only senior field grade that he was able to provide a lot of missing information. They had a lot of information in there that just wasn't true. For instance, the New Jersey firing and support, which they did for the battalion, but not in that engagement. They were, 20 miles inland, so that wasn't happening. But it's interesting how these Vietnam veterans, the reason I find that interesting is, for the exact same reason that you keep on, for the reason that you develop PTW, Mac, these guys came back into individuals, they went as individuals, came back as individuals, most of them put that shit in a closet and held it at bay, and now here they are, making these efforts, and it's amazing. It's amazing, and I mentioned this only because you might want to bring the old man on to talk about it, because I don't think it was something he anticipated happening in later on in his life, is to be reunited and to go over that again, and how much benefit it's been to him.
Yeah, no, it's and that whole. You know, that whole fraternity, as, you know, they've tried to put that back together. I mean, imagine, you know, just what we're talking about. You go through that level of violence and also that level of frustration as a professional, right? You stow it. You come back to get on with your life. And then you read about, like, I mean, you know, to me, Jack Riley, man, that guy, he comes home. He buys a program. They have the first thing he goes to. It's really interesting him talking about how he learned to how he learned to talk about it. He said, I went, I was at a VA appointment and I'm sitting in the office and another guy from that was in 3rd Marine Division is sitting in there and I saw a tattoo and I looked over and I said, when were you in 3rd Marine Division? And he said, oh, and he tells me when, right? And so they're just chit chatting. And he said, it was the first time I talked about Vietnam. The first time sitting in this doctor's office, otherwise I just had never spoken about it. And he said, I came home and I felt so good. And he said, I noticed it. And then another squad from his platoon, 2nd platoon, right, Indy Company 39, was having a reunion and he went to it. And he said, after that, we decided we had to get the company together. Jack Riley bought a program that had MS-DOS floppy disks. That had phone books from every fucking state in the country, and that's how they found their guys.
Wow, yeah, Jack Riley's a national treasure.
He is,
man.
He is. He is such an inspiration to me. And now he holds, you know, the hands of his Marines as they get their lungs eaten from the outside in by Agent Orange, and says, "Don't worry, you die in peace. We'll take care of your family." Now that is the living embodiment of Semper Fidelis, right?
Yeah.
And that quote that I used that say the truth lands with a thud and needs no salesman, that came into my head listening to Jack Riley. He is fucking legit. And it's guys like that who helped Vietnam veterans who came home and just got fucking treated like garbage.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then even worse, when they decided, you know what? We need to pity these fuckers now. And you know, the whole thing, just the whole Vietnam experience has got some tremendous heroism and some unbelievable fortitude, you know, exemplified. But it also has some of the lowest ways a man can act against another man. And I'm not talking about violently. I'm just talking about the shitty way you can treat somebody who deserves to be treated well.
And I blame the Beatles. My dad was on to that from the very beginning.
I just don't understand. I just don't. In fact, when I started my remarks last week, the first thing I said was, "Are there any Vietnam veterans here?" And it kind of got a chuckle, like. And I said, "Are there any guests or family members here that are Vietnam veterans?" And there was, I mean, oddly enough, there was not. No, wasn't one. And I said, look, you know how when you walk through the casino tonight, do you see the way people looked at you? And the people who, when you went and got drinks, somebody bought your drinks. And the people constantly saying, thank you for your service, you guys look great. I said, whenever you meet a Vietnam veteran, you thank their ass, because what they got told was, take your shit off at the airport, don't talk about it, and don't wear that uniform. They paid for your right to be treated like this. So every chance you get, you find out if there's Vietnam veterans around and you walk up and shake their fucking hand. And and I had a couple of people come up to me afterwards that said, my father's a Vietnam veteran, and you made me cry when you said that. Because, you know, he struggled with it for so many years.
Well, you know, it can go one of two ways. Like, some of the adversity, forget the fact you're getting shot at and you're trying to shoot people. This stuff up there in the north, and even down in the lower parts of, the Marine area there, the southern parts, you know, just misery, you know?
Oh, my God.
James Webb, that feels the fire when he's talking, the lieutenant's talking to the XO of the battalion, which really was 1-5, but they say is 125 in the book, which he knows. He's 1-5 and says, yeah, we used to send them out, you know, for 5 or 6 days and bring them back, and they'd have liberty. Can you imagine that, liberty? They're leaving out for 2 weeks. Now we just leave them out there all the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody jokes about it, right? Back when war was good, right? The army, right, marauding through Europe, getting drunk, right? Right? There's, you know, there's beautiful women where they go, you know, not really. I mean, but at least there was a break in the monotony now, right? Burkered up women, okay, right? No booze and no porn.
Like, yeah.
What kind of war is this?
Well, the truth of it is, it's the war where the big rule is not do something good. Don't do anything that can be construed as bad. Don't do anything that can embarrass me. My promotion is at stake. I need to have a flawless, because you get a guy like a battalion commander like Dave Furness or Joe Twell or like, Dale Alford, he gets the same fit rep as battalion commander. I'm not going to name names, but a guy shit except try and get by who's all, you know, very anxious to burn his dudes or worse yet, cover up for dudes who need to be burned, you know what I mean, in order to have a quiet tour in Anbar province or in Helmand province.
Well, you know, that's one of the criticisms that I've been told about our commander's courses. They're not commander courses. They're how not to fuck it up courses.
That's it. Yeah, they're basically like the FBI. Like, I remember reading that book by Gordon Liddy. What the fuck's the name of it? Anyway, it was about Gordon Liddy's biography, basically. And Will. And he says, the thing you got from the FBI from the get-go was, don't embarrass the Bureau. And they made no bones about it, you know? If you get caught doing something, you take it. Even if you got told to do it by your special agent in charge. And they go through a couple of vignettes, you know, that they say you are responsible for success. But if the success you make is the FBI's, the failure you do trying to get that success is your own. And it's guaranteed for the wheels to come off that thing, you know. Yeah. And it has, in my opinion.
Let me read you an email. Kent State, Jeff is right. It's not quite as cut and dried as they just started shooting into the crowd. There was shit going on, buildings being burned. Right. Not that it should have happened, the fog of war shit. Well, my point is this, it's not a war. When you hand live ammunition to reservists, right?
Yeah.
And where is that going to go? Are you going to shoot looters? That's a police event, you know, with the National Guard maybe supporting closing off, coordinating, you know, the university or whatnot, but it's just like you try to, like, what was the sequence of event that led to that? I mean, kind of like taking apart My Lai, and so when I think about My Lai, it's like, you know, Ernest Medina stands up and says, everybody in that village is VC when we go in there tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Right? First of all, all the civilians will be gone to the market, right? Everybody left in there is VC. Got it.
Right.
What about women and children? And then, you know, you hear Barnado Simpson say, everybody's VC in that village. Women, children, dogs, cats, water buffaloes. And it's like there wasn't a lieutenant. There wasn't a staff sergeant, a sergeant first class, right? They put their hand up and say, sir, we can't do that.
Yeah.
Nobody.
And, you know, fuck. It's like,
there are places, there are times when you guys and me too, when we rolled through villages where everybody was Taliban, every woman, child, and dog was Taliban. So what?
Yeah.
So what? That has nothing to do with can you shoot them? That's two different things. Observations.
Yeah, we're the fucking good guys, man. We're not the bad guys. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, one of the hardest things that I used to have to do was when after we would get somebody killed, right? And now we're chasing people, right? And we're using drones and we got Marines moving, right? And you've got aviation overhead. And, you know, positive ID is a big deal in our rules of engagement. And when you lose positive identification, you lose some of your ability, you know, to exact what you want to exact. And what you have to do then is temper it and say, right, we're now going to cordon and search, okay? We can't smoke that thing because we don't know what's in that building. There might be other people in there. And, you know, and people's blood is up, right? When Marines get killed or wounded, right, you want to kill somebody. And then to look at everybody and say, okay, dial this fucking shit down, everybody, right? You know, we're not going to shoot it. We got to wait for whatever battalion to get those guys in position because we can't drop that. And people are fucking pissed, man.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, though, and this is something that's been refined by our enemies really dramatically since the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia. You actually had these crowds, anti-American crowds, UN crowds, basically providing moving cover for gunmen. And sometimes these gunmen would shoot 2-3 magazines at the soldiers there and then put the rifle up against a tree and run away. Now, that guy deserves to get killed who does that, even though he's unarmed.
Right.
You know? And the crowd, if necessary, to keep from being overrun, you need to shoot into that crowd, weapons or not, because otherwise you're going to lose. And the stipulations and rules of engagement don't cover that stuff.
Right, right.
I mean, they don't cover it as explicitly as it needs to be, and they don't put enough trust, you know, in the people who are dealing with it. But I'll tell you right now, I think they whack.
History does, if you know about Chosin Reservoir and the pulling out part.
Yeah.
Explain that.
You get it then, too.
Explain that.
Well, when the Marines were pulling out of Chosin Reservoir, right, so they've linked up with the 1st Marine Regiment. The entire division is now coming out on foot. They're carrying the wounded, all their dead, all the equipment, all the Army guys they could get. There were thousands of refugees behind them, North Koreans, who were holding their children. It was, you know, minus 30. It was pitifully cold. But mixed in amongst the refugees were Chinese soldiers who would constantly come up and start throwing grenades and kill Marines in the rear guard. And so they had to keep the civilians away from the Marines. They fully intended to evacuate them when they got to the water. But there were times when they started overwhelming, they had to open fire. There was no other way to keep everybody out of there. And when they would do that, the Chinese behind in the crowd would open fire. Lots of civilians got killed. It was a damn tragedy, but there was nothing else that could have been done.
I've seen civilians interviewed, right, that said that, you know, the Chinese would herd them toward, and they knew what was going to happen, that the Chinese would, you know, were using them, and they knew it. And if they didn't do what the Chinese said, they would have shoot them.
And the Chinese did that with children against the Iraqis.
Right.
Entire battalions of children with little plastic keys to heaven around their necks, just to clear out the mines and deplete the machine gun ammo.
Yeah, you know, when you're talking about like a place like Kent State or even a riot, you know, if people are committing arson right in front of you, you need to shoot them. Not all of them. You need to shoot enough so that they stop. I mean, that's why it says that, you know, when we do deadly force, it's to prevent fire and disorder. I mean, there's a reason that's in there, because that is, you know, that that's something we can't allow. And the only way you can stop it is with deadly force. Because the mentality of a person in a mob is they're afraid, they want peace, I want anarchy. And that is a tremendous advantage for the cowardly part of the mob, you know, individual who's just trying to cause trouble. The only way you can stop it is to shoot some of them. You need to fire into the crowd. Otherwise, it won't stop until they're just sick of it. And what you end up then is, and now you can say, well, it's not worth anybody's life. There's people who own businesses. There's people who have their property destroyed by these people for no other reason other than, you know, a mass temper tantrum, you know, of a bunch of undisciplined, you know, punks, really. And that's why I could see that being done. You got to let it, not let it get overboard. But in my opinion, Kent State wasn't overboard. They shot 8 people. 4 of them died. And the riot stopped. You let them burn fucking buildings just because they're mad? Get out of here, man.
Yeah, but again, the appropriate response. So this is kind of interesting because it gets me back to a discussion that I enjoy having. And one of the great things, that I learned at the basic school in was that about, you know, this is bad or that's bad. There's no technique that's good or bad. It's the misapplication of a technique into a situation.
That's right.
Right? That it doesn't belong. So when you inject the National Guard with live ammunition into that, you're going to get what you get. Right? So whoever, right, put them in that position and gave them that, set the wheels in motion for something really fucked up to have happen. You know? And why they were there. Right. And if they were not prepared to use deadly force, then why in the fuck did you put those guys in that situation and give them live ammunition? You know, when to me, right, the appropriate arm to use is the police, the state police. I mean, what you saw and then the military in kind of an overwatch position. Right. And you saw that down in Mississippi with the state police until the governor told the attorney general to go fuck himself.
Do you remember the L.A. riots?
No shit.
First L.A.R., the one where they rolled out L.A.R. from Pendleton and they were screaming up there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so and the mayor of Los Angeles is like, no, we're not having armored vehicles in the streets. You know, the LABs are pretty potent looking. And so I believe what they did is they paired up Marines in the back of squad cars.
Right.
And the story I heard at some professional law enforcement conference, it was about communicating with Marines and other military types.
Cover me.
Was that they were, these two Marines were in the back of a squad car with two officers. And if they get a call for a guy that's got a gun in his, is periodically plinking out of his bedroom window, but they knew this guy. This was an old guy who had mental health problems, and it was a pellet gun. And the police knew that, right? So they go rolling up. There's already a unit there, and they get out of the car. They tell the Marines, they're behind the car looking just in case. They said, hey, you guys cover us. We're going to go talk to these officers. And the Marines go, roger that. So the cops started walking towards the officers, and the Marines start hammering away, wham, 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 laying down the covering fire. And, you know, the guy threw his rifle out and starts, you know, yelling, Jesus, I'm just, what the hell is wrong with you guys? It was one of those things, but using the military and the civilian law enforcement, because that was, I thought that was a kind of a funny story. As I recall, the Marines at the time didn't, but it was, I thought it was hysterical.
Yeah, I heard that story from Mike Maiman, who was my buddy, who was a DA in Riverside. He had been a cop before. Cops, and they loved that story about Marines in a good way.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, I've heard it. I've heard it 100 times when I was teaching out at Las Vegas. I'm teaching the pistol. The cops love that story.
But again, and so to me, you know, once you set those wheels in motion and make that decision, you know, and then there's going to be people that say, "Oh, that's not what we wanted them to do. That's not what we wanted them to do." But you've got to understand that when you do that, right? That's not an X-Acto knife you're wielding. It's a sledgehammer. It's a sledgehammer. And there's going to be people that are part of the sledgehammer that don't see it exactly the way you see it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the people who really should have been prosecuted, they should have found who they were the people who were behind that demonstration. A couple of, I think an ROTC kid was one of the dead guys. He wasn't a demonstrator. He's just walking
in the class.
Yeah. There's a girl who had nothing to do with it either, and she was not even I think she was, I don't know what she was doing there, but she had nothing, she wasn't involved, but she got hit by one of the and it's an M1, pretty potent weapon, you know? And, it was, so there's that. And so who should be responsible? The persons, people who caused the anarchy. Now, you know, I was in Iran, and like I was telling you guys when we were talking about that, the army just showed up and shot people who were demonstrating. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who are setting fires, throwing Molotov cocktails, that type of thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that whole civil, when you get to that, well, I'll tell you what's another interesting thing. Iran's got its hands full, eh, boys?
I was just going to say that. Oh, yes, they do. Mrs. Smith was quite prescient in her observations.
Yeah.
I pinged her. She's gone silent on me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I gotta. I don't know. Somehow get her to come out and play again. But it certainly is interesting. And I don't know who's spawning that, right? Because I think one of the things that my time certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan taught me is that I don't believe in coincidences for fuck. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. That if it's happening, somebody's paying for it to happen, and somebody wants it to happen. Who is it?
Yeah.
So they dissuaded me of, oh, that's a coincidence. Yeah, it ain't a coincidence, all right? It's happening because somebody's encouraging it. Who's encouraging it?
What would happen if President Bush suddenly decided for national security there's no more internet access? Everything's in an intranet to the United States controlled by him. Because that's what the Iranian, that's what the mullahs have done to the people there.
Well,
that's a fatal error. That's a self error. They did that. That is a stupid move.
First
to go
of all,
close kimono.
First of all, bro, President Bush.
I mean, I'm sorry, Trump. It doesn't matter. I mean,
dude.
America, an American president cuts off our access to the internet.
Holy
shit,
man! You only missed it by what? About 10 years? 11 years?
No, but yeah, I know what you're talking about, man. Yeah, you know, the Iranians, they got issues. They don't have, it's not a homogeneous country. As a matter of fact, a lot of these other places that have, that we're dealing with, that's the reason why the sanctions work so good with Iran, is because it encourages factions within the place to, you know, to cause trouble. And the same thing in China, I think, although I know way less about China than I know about Iran.
Yeah, but come on, that doesn't stop us from talking about it.
No, yeah, right. But
I don't care what you say about the Chinese military. They're running a military based on 2-year conscripts. I'm not going to get too excited about their technical prowess.
Yeah, which is almost identical to what the Soviets do. And look at what that got them. You know, as far as Afghanistan and stuff like that. Yeah.
No, it's the only way they can do it, though, right, boys?
There's no NCO corps when you do that.
All right.
That means
they didn't even have NCOs in the Chinese Army until 1998.
Yeah.
There wasn't even a rank.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. Any saved rounds?
No, it was good doing this, though.
I enjoyed doing this. I remember 1980 during the Iranian hostage crisis, there were gigantic protests in D.C. by Iranians against us. They were pro-regime, anti-American.
Yes, I
went and watched one with my roommate T.J. Radovich, who's from New York City. He's taller than me. He's about 6'6" guy. And we shadowed this protest the entire way. And then when the thing reached the end of it, I think Massachusetts Avenue kind of broke apart. We followed these guys, and then it kind of wheeled down until it was just three guys. And we followed them the whole way. And those guys turn around and they look, man, we got nothing against your country. And TJ and I are just looking at him, and TJ holds up his camera and goes, because we had our Khomeini sucks t-shirts on, because we're like, you know, we're enlisted guys. We said, nobody's trying to get a picture with our t-shirts. And they're like, oh, thank God. It was funny. But the point being that you get people out of crowds, you get Iranians talking to Americans at an individual level. We've got no issues. We've got no issues with them. None.
But follow these Antifa guys.
Yeah, Iranians are good people. They make interesting companions in Dubai if you're stuck there.
Whoa.
They really do. It's nothing against the people, but they are screwed right now, and I don't think they're going to take it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Did you know on this date, Charles de Gaulle was born in 1890. What's Charles de Gaulle's greatest achievement?
His greatest achievement?
Bullying the Allies into letting him run the show for France.
Yeah.
How's that for bitter?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of something nice to say about the guy.
It's like trying to think of something nice to say about Montgomery. It's very, very difficult.
Yeah, it's like, you know. I guess he was the non-communist, because the French Resistance, you know, had two factors. It had the communists who were cohesive and shit. Then you had the non-communists. And I think he was kind of like a rallying point for the non-communists, you know, even though he was in England, first in North Africa and then in England.
Well, do you think his greatest achievement is the symbolic leader of exiled France, free France, in Great Britain during the build-up before? Or do you think it was later as, president of France from, 58 to 69, something like that, 70?
I think when he was president of France, his insistence on getting nukes and all that shit caused, had a direct result in this whole Cuban Missile Crisis thing.
And Vietnam. Vietnam was in no small part because of his obstinance with that freaking particular issue, because we weren't down on their side when that started.
Right.
Yeah, he was all over that, keeping hold of everything, until all of a sudden he just said, no, we're not.
I mean, all of a sudden after Dien Bien Phu.
No, I mean, that's just
getting hammered in Algeria. That wasn't a cakewalk.
Hey, how did they lose at Dien Bien Phu? What, I've never really studied Dien Bien Phu.
They didn't picket the hills like we did at Khe Sanh. It was very similar to Khe Sanh, that you had in the mountainous areas, you had a high plateau that the French chose an objective to break up the Viet Minh, as it was known then.
Right.
They manhandled a bunch of 105s and 155s through the mountains, so they had artillery on the high ground dominating the French positions, and they just pounded them. French couldn't get resupplied because the only way you in or out of there is by air, and they had to surrender. Now, when a Frenchman says, I have to surrender, it means they're out of croutons or whatever, maybe. But, you know, these guys, no shit, really had to surrender. And Khe Sanh was similar, except the Marines had 881, 861, 881 north and south, till 950. They basically had the high ground around the plateau base of Khe Sanh.
And the French had more artillery and bigger area to work with. They were convinced they could dominate it by fire and that the air would back up what their artillery couldn't. But much like we talk about Marines getting always wanting to get, you know, the biggest fear they have is being sent back to the rear after wounded, you still had French paratroopers jumping into that place 2 days before it fell. I mean, long after they should have surrendered, they're still reinforcing it by guys that are going, yeah, I'll go fight. And they're never to be heard from again, of course. But, the French could fight when they got their fur up. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's like you can have a tough tactical forces like the French paratroopers, French Foreign Legion, but if the heart of the military is corrupt, is weak, like the government, you know, the government didn't have the will to, they had the will to go in there and start that thing. Not, you know, negotiate with Ho Chi Minh and not recognize that, because Ho Chi Minh, he was asking, hey, can you guys send me a copy of your Constitution and your Declaration of Independence and stuff?
Yeah, he quotes it.
You know.
He quotes it. And you hear it, well, in Ken Burns' Vietnam thing, you know, but the run-up to the war, I mean, you hear Ho Chi Minh, right? You hear him quoting the Constitution and you're like, how did we fuck this up, one boy? How did we fuck this up, boys? This guy was on our side.
We had American officers liaisoning with him during World War II. Yeah, the OAS had guys in there. And they said, hey, man, don't back the French. Stay with this guy. He's okay. He's a nationalist. What a shame.
I know. What a waste.
What a shame.
What a waste.
I know.
All right.
He was a son of a bitch, and he did have the blue balls, the crabs, and the seven-year itch. Everyone knows that.
There it is. That's exactly right.
There you go. On that, have a great weekend, guys. Thank you.
You're right. Thanks, Matt.
No worries, Matt.
There you have it. By popular demand today, with the chef out of action, the Monkey Brothers Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny here on a Friday edition of All Marine Radio. On an extended version, even, no less. Come on, man. You got the Monkey Brothers and, I mean, come on. How good is that? Anyway, that'll do it on a Friday. If you're just tuning in, I'm trying to remember what we talked about in hour one. The chef is down. Mike Etor will send you a new book. I want everybody to remember this. You have to agree to do this. Okay? One, you have to read the entire book. That you have to agree to participate in one of our discussions that we're going to do here on All Marine Radio. And then you have to post an honest 2-3 sentence book review on Amazon. And if you'll agree to that, he'll send you a book. Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. How about that for a deal?
That's good.
All you got to do is you got to send it to info@fidelisleadership.com. Now, if you can't spell Fidelis, then you don't get a fucking book, okay? So that's the way that goes. Yeah, and that's all one word. info@fidelisleadership.com. And Mike Etor's on the other end of that, okay? So don't be fucking around, because Etor will yoke your shit up. So anyway, send him an email, and he'll send you a book, as long as you'll do that. Most importantly, though, this weekend, change somebody's life, man. If you listen to this program, you're familiar with post-traumatic winning, right? Go change somebody's life. And it's the coolest experience you'll ever have. And if you'll poke around post-traumatic winning a little bit, all you got to do is share the traumatic wisdom that comes from our culture. Give of yourself. And as we all know, and as we all experience, everybody you hear does it. There's no greater experience in life than changing somebody else's life. And so do that. So do that. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week as we get ready for Thanksgiving. So, have a great day on a Friday. All Marine Radio, over and out.